The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 699 for Monday, March 5th, 2018. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show that takes your tips, your questions, your cool stuff found. We mix it all up and we make like salad. It's like salad. But the thing is, the extra ingredient, the dressing on the salad, is answers to your questions, hopefully, and all sorts of other little delicious things, like maybe a crouton here or there in the form of a quick tip that you didn't even know was coming. All that great stuff right there. And because it's salad, it's healthy and good for you, too. Sponsors for this episode include Smile, where at textexpander.com/podcast, you get 20% off of your first year's subscription to Text Expander. We'll talk more about that in a minute. And also Barebone Software, the makers of the fine BB Edit, now tastier because it's 64-bit. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in fearful Connecticut, getting ready for yet another winter disaster. This is John F. Braun.
How you doing, Mr. John F. Braun?
Now you saw we're going to get another one.
I heard people talking about that. That's right. Yeah. Did you get anything? Have we spoken since there was something Friday or whatever that you got, but we didn't.
Yeah,
really,
it was wind.
Right?
Wind and rain.
That's okay. So we got the same thing. Wind and rain. That's right. But actually, I say that, and it's true. We did get wind and rain here. But, you know, 10 miles away down on the coast, some like major, massive flooding. And also in Boston, too, massive flooding. So,
same here. I saw, you know, a lot of coastal territories near me got big flooding. Our town has actually put measures in place to make sure that doesn't happen. And, it's actually lowered my flood insurance.
Hey, that's good.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
But, and as far as salad, you know, salad's okay.
I don't know where that came from, man.
Once you put the dressing on, it's not healthy. And salad is definitely not.
No. You can have healthy dressing. And we do.
Oh.
Our dressing is healthy. Yeah. You just don't get the stuff with all the, like make your own and make it non-fat if you want even. It's all good for you.
I like blue cheese myself.
Oh, see, I put oil and vinegar on. Olive oil. And now that's still got fat in it. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But, you know, it's olive oil. I figure that's good for you. I don't know. Let's talk about, like, Mac stuff, though. Let's go to Eric here. And if I can pull up Eric's question, I will ask it. Do you have a trusted Mac app that securely deletes files? After I make an encrypted image of my passwords, I'd like to securely delete the source files. So this is an interesting one, John, because I used to be able to in the Finder, I could option click the Finder menu and get it to change from empty trash to secure empty trash. However, that doesn't exist anymore. And I think the reason it doesn't exist is because I'm running SSDs on all the Macs upon which I can test it. And I don't think they, right? Because you can't secure delete on an SSD because the file system can't overwrite a file like that. It just it doesn't work that same way.
Well, I think it's because with an SSD, you can't really predict what memory cell is being used for a write operation.
Correct.
Probably
for
read
a write operation. That's right. Yeah. Even when you overwrite a file.
So where we talk secure erase, so what we mean by secure erase is that you basically, and actually you can do this with a rotational drive, like even with this utility, and it basically rolls through the drive and writes various patterns to every sector, which you can predictably do on a rotational drive, but you cannot do on an SSD. However, there is, you know, I know we had this come up. The thing is, some SSDs support the issuance, I think I got that right, of a secure erase the whole thing command.
Yes, that's right. But not all.
So but through the Finder, you cannot do it.
But you also can't reliably recover anything from an SSD either. So, like, there's trade-offs. So I think the point is, not only is Secure Erase not doable on an SSD in many cases, but I don't want to say all, it's also not necessarily as important as it was on a rotational drive, or as it is on a rotational drive. That said, really the way to do this is to use whole disk encryption, like, you know, FileVault 2, and then you're golden, I think. And then that's that. But you could use something like CleanMyMac has a shredder functionality inside it. So you could do that if you so desire. Right?
So again, I don't know if, I'm with you. I don't know if with an SSD that necessarily use whole disk encryption.
There you go.
That's, I think, is the answer.
Yeah.
So unless somebody manages to guess your password.
Right. Yes, your encryption key. That's right. Yep.
Your encryption key, then, that should do it for you.
Cool.
Right?
Yeah, okay. I think so. All right. Finn asks, he says, I've got a Mac Mini from 2010, and I installed an SSD in it that I use via home sharing to watch movies on my Apple TV. I noticed that after the SSD was installed, it now has a different name under Find My iPhone. It used to say, or maybe, I don't know if he means Find My iPhone, but he says it. Oh, yeah. That's probably true. It says it used to say Finn's Mac Mini, but now says Mac's MacBook. I went to the Genius Bar and they told me to reset my Apple TV, but this has not helped. I've tried reinstalling OSs, of course, and have home sharing turned on. Everything else works. I can AirPlay to the TV. It did ask for a code for my Mac, or on my Mac from the TV. Tried everything. Please help. So I think he's talking about I think he's talking about the home sharing name, but maybe I'm missing something here. It's hard to understand. Well, the home sharing name, there are two places where you can set the name of your Mac. One is if you go to System Preferences, Sharing, Computer Name, and that will let you set the name of your computer there. And that's what should appear when you look for, you know, Find My Mac and all that stuff. And then for home sharing, that's in a different spot. That's in iTunes, Preferences, General, Library Name. And that's where you set what appears in home sharing for your iTunes library. And the nice part, the reason you would want to have a different name there is you could use two separate iTunes libraries. Here comes one of those croutons, right? When you launch iTunes, if you hold down the Option key, you'll get a dialog that lets you select a different library or create a new one. And of course, then you would have two libraries and you might want to name them differently so that you know which one you're attaching to remotely or from another. Not remotely, but from a different computer on the same network. So that's where I'm at with it. What do you think, John?
I don't like sharing, so I don't share. I'm a terrible person.
No. That's right. Well, it's like your sister's more than 4 years older than you, right? Is that right?
No.
Oh, well, no, I was going to say
the delta is 2.
Hmm. Okay, I was gonna say, you know, there was something I was reading where they said that kids that are more than or 4 or more years apart essentially grow up like not that much differently from an only child. So I was gonna give you an excuse for why you didn't like sharing, but sorry, man, I don't have it. I got nothing. Okay, shall we move on to Simon then?
Indeed.
All right. Simon writes, find it. It's always there. Simon writes, how can I get both domains to show up when I am sending email from my iPhone with my Gmail account? I found that if I set up the account manually as an IMAP account, then I can add in the addresses. But if I just set it up as a Gmail account and choose the Gmail path, I cannot add additional addresses. And you're totally right. And he says the problem is this will only allow fetch emails when I set it up manually, whereas I can do push emails if I set it up using the Gmail preference in the mail settings in iOS. And you're totally right about all of those things. Manual accounts can't be pushed. They can only be fetched. And that accounts set up as Gmail in iOS mail cannot have multiple addresses attached to them, whereas manual accounts can. And again, for those of you that like croutons, if you go to settings mail on your iOS device, it's not settings mail anymore. God, I move this stuff around. Settings accounts and passwords on your iOS device. And then you go to your mail account and you go into account again, only for accounts that are manual set up like that. On the email address, you can tap that and you'll see the option then to choose add another email. So this is in settings, accounts and passwords. Then you pick your account and you go into the account and you tap on the email address and you can add a bunch here. And if your outgoing mail server supports it, you can send mail from all of those different addresses. Here's the frustrating part. If you go into Gmail's web interface, you can do the same thing. You can add accounts in the same way. I mean, you've got to configure them and prove that you own them and, you know, confirm and all that stuff. But you can have them there. Those don't translate over to the iOS mail app when you have it set up as Gmail and there's no way to add on the iPhone. But if you run the Gmail app, like if you go to the App Store and download Gmail, that'll see all those addresses. So you could do it that way if you want to have it set up as Gmail, but then you got to use a different app. So there's like, you don't get, there's like three things and you get to pick your favorite two and that's it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I saw a suggestion here in our chat room. Where is our chat room, Dave?
MacGeekGab.com/stream.
Yes. And we have a lively bunch in there almost every week. No, they're almost lively.
They're always lively. Yeah.
But the other suggestion is you may want to use a different email client. And Kiwi Graham says he uses Outlook.
There you go. Yeah.
For his Gmail accounts. And I think I actually saw that our friend replied to us. And is it Spark, I think?
Uh-huh.
I think that's another client. So the thing is, you may want to try another email client.
But I don't think you'll get push notifications with anything other than Apple's built-in client. I mean, you'll get pseudo push, right? In that you can get a notification if the server supports it. But in terms of like mail actually being pushed to your device, no. The only way to do that is with the mail app, I think. But somebody in the chat room will correct me if I'm wrong. Brian Monroe also there suggests that if this person is truly using the G Suite, which is the Google Apps for Business, then you can use the Exchange option to connect to that. And that will inside mail let you do both of those things. So you could have that if, in fact, it's G Suite. So there you go. Yeah, fun. I don't know. It's crazy. It's always stuff, you know.
That's Google. Always breaking the rules or bending the rules.
Yeah, I don't know.
Whatever they want.
Whatever they want. Yeah, yeah. Brother Jay has an interesting question, John. We're just pouring through these here today. That's good. He says, I know not when it began, but this must end. My built-in annoyance meter can monitor it no more. Every single time a volume, including a snapshot, is unmounted. Oh, I should say that more accurately. And every single time a volume is unmounted, and that includes snapshots, Safari launches. Safari, says, not Safari technology preview, but Safari. And it doesn't load any page. It just comes up blank. I set up no automation anywhere. Why does macOS launch Safari, a browser I never use, whenever a volume is unmounted? This peculiar behavior has persisted since the initial batch of High Sierra public beta builds. The only thing about which I am certain is that this has gone on far too long, and I am thoroughly annoyed, irritated, and exasperated. Okay. Yeah, that's weird, man. It shouldn't happen, of course. Doesn't happen here. Probably doesn't happen for you, right, John?
How would you even make that? I'm just trying to think how you even make that happen.
Well, that's what I started thinking. Right. Is if I wanted, if that were desired behavior, how would I do it? And that's when I came up with launch services. Launch services can be done, can be used to do a lot of cool things, and it can trigger off of many, many things in the OS. And so it's possible that you've got something out there in launch services that is set, that has essentially told the system, anytime a disk is ejected, go and do this other action, which in your case results in launching Safari with a blank window. The way to check that, the best way to check that is to use a third-party app called Lingon, L-I-N-G-O-N. And Lingon will show you everything in launch services. And I'm hoping that on your system, you'll find something. Because other than that, I mean, I guess there could be a background app running, right? You know, you could have some menu bar extra or something running that that does that. I mean, I that would be the other way, right? It's a process, but you could do it there. I don't know. Where else, John? Right? A third-party app could do that if it were running all the time, I think.
And I'm wondering if, I mean, we talked recently about default apps. it's a utility that shows you what extensions are mapped to certain actions.
Okay.
But that could get tedious trying to go through that and find out what is making this happen. But there may
be. Well, but it might not be an app. That's what I'm saying is. I mean, it could be, but I don't, like, what app would that, I don't think there's a URL called when a drive's ejected.
WebDAV, maybe, kind of, you know?
When a drive's ejected?
WebDAV is kind of a URL way to access drives and unaccess them.
Yeah, okay. I see where you're going with this.
I'm kind of reaching.
No, but okay, right. Yeah, so checking to see what WebDAV is set to open with. All right.
So WebDAV, for those who don't know, so WebDAV is a protocol where you can access a drive over HTTP.
Right.
Did I get that right? Yeah. Right. So, yeah. And you can access WebDAV drives with a URL usually begins, I guess, with WebDAV.
Does right? it? That's what I'm checking here. No, Safari can't open WebDAV drive.local because macOS doesn't recognize internet addresses starting with WebDAV. No, I think WebDAV is HTTP. I don't know. I don't use it often.
Maybe
enough.
Other browsers honor it, but just reaching.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would go with the I'd look in Lingon.
I would say burn it with fire.
Alex in the chat room suggests starting up with the shift key held down to skip all of the third party apps from launching would rule out whether or not this is an app, and so at least there would be that. I don't think it turns off launch services, so that would be one way of isolating. If it still happens that way, at least then you know without driving yourself crazy, just quitting
right,
everything, you know whether it's an app or not.
Holding down shift is safe mode, which loads only Apple stuff and not third-party stuff.
Right.
So, right?
Right. That's correct. Yes. Yeah. That's right. Yep.
Yeah. Or again, like I said, burn it with fire just to, you know, reformat and you don't want to do that.
So
it's a good question. I think it's a geek challenge because I've never seen that.
So Alex also found a piece of software. This might turn into more of a crouton than anything else. He found something called Undock from Flying Paper Software. And what Undock does is a simple critical piece to your Mac, an eject all shortcut with superpowers. So maybe, I don't know. It's a cool thing, though, right? You can eject all your removable drives with one click. So it's like a surprise cool stuff found is what that is. I don't think that would be the cause of this. And Alex agrees, actually. But that's a pretty cool one. I like that. So we'll call that the bonus cool stuff found right there. I like it. Good.
All right.
Hey, so you know what I want to do? I want to talk about both of our sponsors here, John. And then I want to talk about Qi, because we have a lot to talk about with Qi, I think.
Why did they spell it wrong?
Well, that's how it's been spelled for forever. Oh, okay. All right. Cool.
It just irks me.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to talk about our sponsors here. Our first sponsor for today is Smile, where at smilesoftware.com/podcast, or actually textexpander.com/podcast, you get 20% off your first year of Text Expander, which is a tool that I can't imagine not having on my Mac. In fact, as we were prepping the show today, I invoked one of my Text Expander snippets. We have one that takes an Amazon URL and converts it into a Mac Geek Gab affiliate URL, which is what we use like in our show notes and stuff. And I invoked that. Nothing. Didn't work. I'm like, oh, that's right. I was doing something else before and I was quitting apps and I wound up quitting Text Expander. So, of course, I relaunched Text Expander, but it had actually been off for a couple hours, but I hadn't used this computer in those couple hours. It took minutes of useful time for me to realize it wasn't running. And it's used for exactly that. Like you can do various things. Like I talk about how I have your address in there, John, so that when people ask to ship you something, I can just type JBADD and boom, it fills out your address. I don't have to remember your address or anything.
That's your shortcut for me.
What's that?
That's your shortcut for me.
Well, mine for me is DHADD for address. There's no diagnosis involved in this, John. It's just JBADD and boom, there's your address. Yep.
Oh, okay. I thought you were,
not diagnosing. Nope.
Medical.
That's right. But you can also do cool things like where I have a piece of an Amazon URL. I take the product ID and I put that on the clipboard. And then I have a Text Expander snippet that builds the whole URL, putting that part from the clipboard in exactly the right spot. Right. So it can be really, really smart about these things. I highly recommend you check this out. It's one of my favorite utilities. So please do go to textexpander.com/podcast, and that's where you can download it and get all set up, and you get 20% off of your first year. So our thanks to the folks at Text Expander and Smile for sponsoring this episode. Barebones is our second sponsor. And Barebones also makes a piece of software that I rarely don't have running on my Mac. And of course, BBEdit is what I'm talking about. And that is running on my Mac right now. I use it to manage all the text files for our show notes. I use it, of course, when I'm programming and need to edit some code, either PHP or JavaScript. But you can, just because I don't code in C doesn't mean you can't. And if you do, well, BBEdit will recognize that and format the text on the screen nicely for you. You can use it to count words in documents. You can use it, I do all the time, to compare two text files. Really handy. And you can invoke it from the terminal. Who doesn't like that? You go to the terminal, but, you don't want to have to, edit in a, nano window or an Emacs or, heaven forbid, a VI window. Although I prefer VI to Emacs, actually.
Hey, careful.
I like VI. My fingers know how to do it, but I don't like to do it. So, but I type BBEdit and edit there, and now I get to use my mouse and be, civilized. I don't have to be fighting in the command line or whatever. So it's really awesome. You got to check it out. Go to barebones.com. Check out BBEdit. I mentioned it last time, and I'm going to mention it this time. Now, with version 12.1, 64 bits of goodness. Yes, that's right. BBEdit is ready for the future. That app, I think, is more than twice as old as this podcast, if that's telling you something. And now, up to date, 64 bits, ready for the future. Our thanks to the folks at Barebones at barebones.com for sponsoring this episode and for making BBEdit, really, for everything. Thanks, folks. All right, now it's time for some Qi love, John. So
Qi, spelled Qi.
Qi, which is what we also
that
call...
That just irks me.
Yeah, we call it wireless charging. I really, we should be calling it contactless charging, right?
Well, because, inductive. Inductive charging.
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
Most accurate term. It's magic, but it's a electromagnetic magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's the thing that allows you to take your iPhone 8 or 8 Plus or iPhone 10 and put it on some sort of magic pad that then just starts charging. You don't have to plug it in. It's beautiful. If you have one of these, Apple doesn't include a cheap pad in the box, but you can go and get one, and they're relatively inexpensive. You can get them for like about $10. John and I, we've been through a few of these things, and I wanted to kind of go through it because one of the most important places that I can think of to charge your Qi devices or your iPhone is right next to your bed. And it's super convenient if you don't have to fool with plugging in a cord every time. But what's worse is when you've got a bright blue light shining in your eye, trying to sear your retina through your eyelid throughout the night just because your phone is charging next to the bed. So we started looking at these things, and we found some that work next to the bed very well, and we found some that don't. So I'm going to start with one that doesn't. The first one that I got is the PowerBot Qi Puck. That has very bright LEDs. It's green when it's not doing anything, and it's blue when it's charging. And it's $10 on Amazon. I use it at my desk, and I love it. It's great, but wow, it's way too bright next to the bed. So I say no bedtime for the PowerBot Qi Puck, but it's $10. So, you know, cool. Yeah. Right, John? Good?
Good. Okay. No, I don't like, and you know, I got to shake, I have to say, I shake my fist at any vendor that makes a product that has blindingly bright blue LEDs.
Yeah.
I don't know why some feel it's necessary. Or at least give me an option to turn it off or dim it or something. You
know? Any LED that's lit all the time is too bright, if you ask me. Yes, as Brian Monroe in the chat room says, you can put black tape over, you know, electrical tape or whatever over the light. But I'd actually like to have some indication as to what's going on, because the puck will tell you if there's a problem. Like this one, I think, turns red or it flashes even. If there's an issue and you need to remove the phone and let it reset and then try again. So I'd like to see the light. I just don't want it on all the time. The one that I had been using for a little while is the Monoprice Qi adapter, or puck, rather. I think it sits right at $10. It was when I last looked. That one's pretty good. It's red when it's not charging, and it's blue when it is. But the light's way dimmer than the PowerBot one. So this, I just turned the light away from my bed so it's not aiming at me, and it's fine. It's still there, and it certainly lights up my bedside table enough that I could like fumble around to find chapstick or whatever. But it doesn't keep me awake. So if you want a puck style thing with no light, or not no light, but lower light, the Monoprice one works. What, you have one? You have a puck, right, that you use, John?
Yes, so I got one. It's almost sacrilege, but I think I got it through Thrifter, which is a site we mentioned in the past that lists deals, and although it retails for $40, so it's a Samsung charger, which is why I say it's kind of sacrilege using a Samsung.
Oh, I see.
Makes Android phones to charge an iPhone.
Sure.
But they had a thing, and they're like, yeah, it's $15. Oddly enough, then they redirect you to Amazon, or in my case, they did.
Yeah.
And it's funny, because the black one was $15, and the white one was $40. And I'm like, huh? But okay. Whatever. But I like this one because the LED is subdued. And then it has a blue LED. So the thing is, there's no LED when it's just sitting there. So they give you a USB. I think it's a 2 amp or something. So
sure.
So you have it comes with its own USB wall wart.
Okay.
And then you plug it in, but the thing is, the light is not on unless there's something on it charging. And when it is, it's a very subtle blue LED. The weird thing is that they say in the documentation, which is very sparse, that the LED should turn from blue to green when the phone is fully charged. And at least in the case of my iPhone 8, I never saw it do that.
It just
the thing
off.
Is, it's fine, and it's also a – and I used iStat Mini to measure this. So iStat Mini can actually tell you the power from this. So this thing provides 6 watts of power, which is not fast charging, but it's – you know, I mean, it gets the job done.
Sure.
It will eventually charge it. So I'm very happy with it. And the deals are kind of in flux with this thing because I've seen – to mention another thing that somebody told us about, Honey.
But wait, slow down. Let's just stay on the Qi topic here. I don't want to go
all right,
too
well,
far
we're on
down
the Qi topic.
Yeah. Okay.
But no, so, I'm happy with it. I got 2 of them, $15. It offers 6 watts of power, and there you go. And it doesn't blind you.
That's cool. Yeah, the iPhone will not do the full, 10 watts of fast charging, but it will do up to 7.5 watts of charging if the puck supports it. So, yeah. The third thing that I've tried in the bedroom next to the bed is the one that I'm now using, and it's the Ventev wireless charge stand. This thing's pretty cool because it's got like the typical little puck in it, but the puck is movable inside the stand. So you can set it at the height that makes sense, and you can either have your phone in portrait mode or landscape mode. You just kind of lean it up on this stand and it just starts charging when you lean it up on the stand because you're leaning it up against the puck. But you can adjust the angle of the stand by kind of flipping the stand around, or you can, you can adjust the orientation of your phone on the thing. So that's what I've been using now. It is a 15 watt charger. Of course, it'll only charge the iPhone at 7.5. But what I really like is that when I put my phone on it, it flashes blue for a little while to tell me, hey, you're in good shape. We're charging. And it's a dim blue light at that. And then it goes out. No light on persistently at all. And that to me is the best, because that way I'm not adding any more light to the bedroom. It's just right there. And the phone's up on a thing, so I'm not fumbling around. It's not sliding all over the place. So that's my current one. That one, if you go to Amazon, you can get it. It's not, it's not $10. It's $60. And, but it's got a little more to it. So, you know, and it charges faster and all that good stuff. So there you go. That's my, that's the one I'm using on the bed. I'm traveling though, John. And so I've been thinking, okay, what am I going to use? Because, you know, like, what am I going to use? Well, I could plug my phone in, you know, like a caveman, John, while I'm traveling, but that doesn't sound so good. No, I checked out this thing. It's from a company called Bezalel, Bezalel. And they actually make quite a few things. But the one that I'm talking about here is their Prelude, which is a portable wireless puck. It has a battery in it. It's, you know, a little thicker than your typical Qi puck, but it's got a battery in it so that you can charge this up and you can charge your phone anytime you want. It's a 7,000 milliamp hour battery. So if you don't have a convenient place on the nightstand in the hotel room to plug in, no problem. Charge the puck up during the day, bring it over to the nightstand, you put your phone on it, you're good to go. Your phone's right there. It's charging wirelessly. Everybody's happy. And you don't need to plug in. It's truly wireless charging, right? It's just right there from the battery. So so that's, you know, and they'll get $60 for that too. But I think that's a pretty cool thing. So I'm looking forward to that with my trip to South by Southwest next week. So that's what I got there, John. I do have a couple other things, but it sounded like you had something to add.
No. Okay. No, South by Southwest, man. Hope you get some, I hear they have good barbecue in Texas.
That's the plan. So while we're on the Qi thing, one more, because to me, this is the place where Qi works really well. I've been a big fan of the mounts in the car that plug into the now unused CD, port, whatever, you know, it just does a pressure mount in there. But the ones I really like are the ones where you put your phone in and there's a little trigger that trips the some clamps that come down and hold your phone. So you can just pop your phone right onto the charger with one hand, and or onto the mount with one hand. Now, previously, I would have to plug in, but IOTTIE makes a OneTouch 4 dashboard and windshield car mount, and it's got a Qi pad right in it. So it, yeah, I know, it's pretty cool, and it works great. I've got it in the car. You just plug it in, and you're good to go. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. It's $50 for the one with the Qi in it. It comes with a suction mount that you can put on your dash or whatever. But IOTTIE has a whole line of products, and so you can, they're sort of modular, so you can take the suction mount off and put a CD mount on, and that's what I've got in the car now. And now I just get in the car and pop it up, and it just automatically starts charging. So it's pretty good, I think. Yeah, you know, why not?
When I posted the stats of that I measured, actually one of my friends, my pal Scott out in Arizona, said, "Oh yeah, my car actually has a Qi charger." I guess that's
really
the latest thing. Apparently some newer vehicles, which is not me,
right,
have that built in along with, you know, all the other high-tech toys like Bluetooth and CarPlay and all that stuff. So,
wow.
That's pretty neat. So that's something to look for in your next vehicle if you want to charge your phone while you're on the road.
Yeah, well, it's nice that this is a standard. Like you said, you bought, you know, a Samsung Qi pad, and we're talking, I mean, we didn't mention one Apple device here, and they all just work because it's a standard, which is, you know, great. Thank you, Apple, for doing that. It's pretty good. Because the watch, I remember when the watch came out, like somebody dug into it and said, yeah, it's Qi, but not really. Not in a way that you could put it on a Qi pad. It needs like the magnets and whatever. So I don't know. It's crazy. What do you think, John? Anything else? Do we have anything else to say on the whole Qi thing? Or are we time to move on?
I'm a fan, you know, decided to upgrade, you know, my phone, even though I didn't have to, but I could. And that's one of the benefits of the 8 or the 10 or the X. 10X? Which is, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's the 10. Yeah. But yeah, it's cool. It's, I like the wireless charging. It's a, and if you've got an 8 or an 8 plus or a 10, and you haven't done this yet, really, it, you know, $10. It's pretty cool to be able to just pop your phone down and have it off and running. So check it out. All right, John. Before we move too far along, I want to say a big thank you to all of our Mac Geek Gab Premium subscribers. So thank you to all of you. If you want to learn more about Premium and you're not already a Premium subscriber, go to MacGeekGab.com/Premium. Or even just MacGeekGab.com. There's a link right there, obviously. You can learn about it. It's really for those of you that can and want to support us directly. And so we've got it all set up. You do get access to a very special premium at MacGeekGab.com email address where we prioritize those questions that come in and we try to help you out as much as we can. So it's our way of saying thank you back. This week we had on the biannual $25 every 6 month plan, we had Nick S, Martin B, Peter M, Jonathan C, Seth R, Bartek B, Eric WB, Gene R, Sandpiper, Bruce W, Randall S, Rob H, Daniel C, Jeff S, Douglas S, Bob P, and Matt C. And in the monthly $10 plan, we have Chris F., The B-Man, Michael L., Bob P., Jason A., Olga P., Greg S., Ward J., Petter H., Jim E., Elizabeth B., David M., and John B., and then also on the monthly plan, but at 15, Micah P. So thank you to all of you. Really, it's awesome, and it inspires us to really keep doing what we're doing here, and we appreciate it. So thanks. Shall we go on to a question, a last minute entry to the agenda, John?
Whoa. All right.
Yes. Pre-show network guy in the chat room asked, if money were no object, what is the fastest wireless router? And it's actually kind of interesting because We've been talking about this. The three of us, but also with Allison Sheridan is the third party here, because she started doing some testing and asking some really good questions, and she put an article up. We'll actually link to it, where she tested two Netgear routers. She tested the Orbi Mesh and the Nighthawk X8. And as she was testing them, she shot me an email and said, "Why am I seeing much faster speeds? You know, from the X8, the standalone router, as opposed to the Orbi, which is mesh. Isn't mesh supposed to be faster?" And right, and the answer is, well, you know, it depends, because the X8, if you want a fast router, truly where speed is the most important thing, a 4x4 wireless router, which means it has four streams in each direction on each radio, is going to be the fastest. Even though most of your Apple devices only support 2x2, a 4x4 router can tune the best two streams towards you, as opposed to just its only two streams if it's just a 2x2 router. And Allison was seeing like double speeds. She saw, what, 338 megabits per second on the Nighthawk X8, and it was like 170 something on the Orbi. Now, so there, to answer your question, the Nighthawk X8 is most definitely a router to consider. It's one of my favorites. It's from Netgear. It's a 4x4 router. It's actually got three radios in it. It's got 2 5 gigahertz and one 2.4 gigahertz. And every single one of them is a 4x4 radio. So you've got all those streams, which is great.
So you got the streams, and then you got the frequency, and then I guess you got the negotiated. What the heck? I just want to help people understand the multiple factors here. So one is the number of streams. So more is better, of course. But then the frequency that's selected is another aspect of this. And then the speed that is negotiated between the client and the router is the third part of it. And if all the gears mesh, then you get these wonderful speeds.
That's true. That's right. Yeah. But even when the gears don't all mesh, and no pun intended with that, using that word, a 4x4 router in all the tests that I have done winds up serving any client faster than a 2x2 router in the same spot. And that's, again, just because those extra streams can be used to tune and select the best one for that client device. And it really does make a difference. The Synology RT2600AC, which is just a two-band, it's just got one 5 gigahertz and one 2.4 gigahertz. That one also way faster than any of the 2x2 radios that are out there, just because it's got those extra streams. So a 4x4 routers with the extra streams are far and away going to be faster, all else being equal. But it's worth noting that mesh might make things faster if you're having coverage issues, right? Mesh is out there to solve coverage issues and congestion issues, right? Because you've got multiple radios all over the place, so different clients can connect and you're not tying up just one radio or one set of radios on a router. So depending on the shape of your house, if one router serves everywhere in your house, then you might be better off with one of these standalone 4x4 routers like we've just discussed. If you have sort of a sprawling house or things are spread out, or you have, maybe air conditioner ducts or a refrigerator in the wrong place or whatever, something blocking radio waves, then mesh can really be your friend, because it can help you kind of, navigate around that by sort of, relaying the radio waves, as it were. So there you go. That's my thought. Right? It's coverage versus speed, and you got to decide what the right thing is for you. The really nice part about mesh is if you have a problem, you just go and put another mesh point in, and you can begin to solve those problems. Whereas, you know, if you just have a standalone router now, maybe you're trying to move things around and all that stuff. And, you know, even though Allison tested and found that, you know, we're talking about 338 megabits a second in her house versus 170 in her house, 170 is still pretty fast. Like, Netflix isn't going to be any different for you on either of those connections.
No, well, Netflix, even at the highest definition, I think, is less than 10 megabits a second, I think, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need a lot of pipe to do even HD video, so.
Right. So it depends. I mean, if you're really pumping, like, lots of data around, maybe you have you're editing video or like something like that, then
you're downloading. Yeah. Or, you know, pirating, you know, movies and stuff like that.
Yeah. But even then, like, how fast?
And you want the maximum bandwidth so you don't get caught.
Right. Yeah. Good luck with that. Use a VPN so you don't get caught, folks. There's your crouton for that. Yeah. Otherwise your cable company
you really
will
like
catch
croutons,
you.
Don't, wow. I didn't well, know that. Like, I'm going to buy you some croutons.
It's just extra. Brian Monroe asked in the chat room, what's the fastest mesh? He said, isn't the Orbi the fastest mesh? And this is a little bit, there's some points of confusion here. The Orbi, when it talks to clients, is always 2x2 radios. For its backhaul, the high-end Orbi has a 4x4 radio that it talks, that it does all its backhaul with. And that's a separate radio from the two that talk to clients. So it can be faster. But in terms of that raw speed to the client, no, it's not, especially when you're talking right from the router or from the main unit.
Right. But then you mentioned that the mesh products that support wired backhaul, I think, have the potential to offer you better overall performance. And I think the Orbi is one that does support that, right?
It does now, as of November. Yeah, it didn't originally.
Oh, all right.
Yep. Yeah, if you can do wired backhaul, but again, you're still limited to those 2x2 radios on the front haul side.
Right.
But Ubiquiti's Amplify HD has 3x3 radios in it. So I think that's the fastest consumer mesh right now, because all the Eero's are all 2x2. The Orbis are 2x2 to the clients. The Amplify is 3x3. So. But again, it all depends on your layout.
Change that.
What's that?
So I have Eero Gen 1. Didn't the Gen 2 add something?
It added a radio, but it did not
a radio.
It didn't add
a stream.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think I have that right. Right, Eero Gen 2. I'm 99.6% certain about that. Yeah, it's 2x2 radios. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Personally, I mean, with a 1,200 square foot, two-story house here, I'm just fine.
Yeah, you'd be fine with anything we mentioned already. That's right. Yeah. 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 All right. Good. Shall we go on to Bill, John?
Where are we here?
You going to take us to Bill?
Is Bill mine? Oh, yes. This Bill can. This one gets kind of interesting. So let me bring it up here. Yeah, we kind of went all over the place here, but here's what Bill says, and this may be a geek challenge, Dave. I don't know if you read over this, but so Bill says, I've run across some weird macOS 10.13.3 behavior that seems to involve the Finder crashing. I'm having trouble pinning down the cause, however. Some of the symptoms, keyboard maestro can't open Finder windows and macros or log windows from menus. BBEdit, won't close, apparently because it can't read or write a certain file and it won't display lines that contain certain characters, such as a checkmark, then display fine in TextEdit. Another symptom, Carbon Copy Cloner and Backblaze don't run scheduled backups. Another one, I get up in the AM to find the computer has shut down, perhaps when Carbon Copy Cloner or Backblaze tried to run the night before, and Finder windows won't open from the dock. In the first and last case, restarting the Finder usually fixes the problem for a while, and I suspect that the other symptoms may relate back to the Finder and or file system, perhaps Carbon Copy Cloner or Backblaze can't open files, therefore they don't run. Here's what I've done to try to fix it. Run Onyx, and I assume cleaning things up. Run disutility, reboot in safe mode and restart, reinstall OS from recovery, and erase disk and do a clean reinstall. You'd think the last step would fix it if it were a software problem. It seems to be, but if it's hardware, why is it intermittent? Any help would be appreciated. And yeah, I was scratching my head over this, Dave, and a little bleeding. First off, I reflected upon something that's important to me because it's me, but I was having Finder issues on my MacBook Pro recently, running 10.13.3, and it would repeatedly crash and put up a dialog box saying it crashed and would I like to reopen the Windows, and then it would recycle in that. So I've seen this Finder thing as well. I don't know if you have, Dave. Where the Finder, but I've seen it maybe once a month where Finder just gets totally confused.
And does restarting the Finder solve the problem?
No.
You have to reboot the Mac.
Even logging out and logging in, you'd think that would solve the problem, but I found in this case, a restart is necessary in order to fix the problem.
Because for him, restarting the Finder fixes it, at least for a while.
Yeah. But I do agree that erasing and reinstalling should fix any issue, and I think that's where he left it.
It's
and
true.
He did that, and it seems to have gone away. But before taking that step, I would have suggested that he runs. I suspect maybe data corruption.
Well, he didn't. Drive. He says erase disk and do a clean and reinstall didn't do it. Right? He says you'd think that last step would fix it. If it were the software problem, it seems to be. But if it's hardware, why is it intermittent?
It wasn't clear to me if he took that step and kept happening. I'm not clear on that. He says he did that.
Yeah.
And then he was saying.
Yeah, it's true. I'm with you on that. Yep.
All right.
Yep.
And then he asks about the nature of hardware problems. And
they're intermittent.
But to continue, I suspect what happened is that I think he may have had data corruption because the number of things that he mentioned that were not working right would suggest to me that it was data corruption.
Yeah.
So before he did the reformat and all that, the one thing he did not do was run a utility, even something basic like disutility or Drive Genius, to see if there's any data corruption, or running something that can report the smart parameters, which I know we agree that smart is not perfect, but tools such as DriveDX can do some what I'll call predictive failure analysis. They're like, yeah, I see these numbers are increasing and that's not good. So,
this would be an SSD, right?
The full dialogue is not in the box here. My apologies. But he did get back to me and he did say, so this is what makes it even weirder. He's like, yeah, the thing is I did run. So he does have Drive Genius and Drive DX. So that was in a follow-up, which, again, I didn't put that in our box.
No problem.
I'll explain it to you. So he did run Drive DX. So it's an SSD. It's in a newer iMac. And he ran Drive DX. And here's the weird part, though. This is where it goes off the rails, my friend. He ran Drive Genius. And it gave the same error that I got with Drive Genius with my rotational APFS drives. So this is where it goes, again, I'm going to say off the rails, is that when he tried to run Drive Genius on that same drive, it reported, I think, this error 72, which turns out to be an IO error, which is pretty much useless. I mean, it's like, well.
Yeah, but so, IO error could mean that there is a hardware problem with that drive.
And that was my response to him, is that I think it sounds like it is an issue with either your SSD or the connection to the SSD and maybe the controller or the controller in his machine. So yeah. I think the next step, he said, is that he's going to do AppleCare or Genius Bar to determine that. But I'm really, you know, after hearing all of the stuff that he said here, I'm really leaning towards a hardware issue versus data corruption.
Yeah, I would wipe the drive and start. I mean, if he says he's done the
erase
disk.
I mean, he did that already, though.
Yeah.
Well, he did it already, and it sounds like the problems have...
Yeah, that's right.
Other than Drive Genius saying, oh, yeah, I have this weird error.
It's the hard drive. Yeah, if he's erased it. I mean, that's the test, right? If it's file system corruption, wiping the disk and doing a clean reinstall is going to address that. So, yeah, it's a problem with the SSD. Yeah, or, like you said, the controller or the cable, any of those things. Yep.
Right.
Alex...
So I'm hoping...
Alex in the chat room had an interesting thought kind of as we were going through this, and it's worth throwing out there, not necessarily for this problem, but as other people are going through different things. Alex says, you know, when he said that it wouldn't display lines containing certain characters that display fine in text edit, he's like, well, they both use different fonts, right? BB Edit uses one set of fonts, text edit uses another. And it's entirely possible that those fonts have gotten corrupted. So checking those fonts and going into Fontbook and looking and having it do a check of all the fonts, that would not be a bad thing. And Alex actually points out that it could still be that if he restored from a Time Machine backup, because if there was a corrupted font file, well, then that's, you know, that would come back. So. It's worth remembering. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, I've used it in the past, and yeah, sometimes, you know, I'll find duplicate fonts, which could cause problems. And,
yep. Well, and you can just use it to validate fonts. So it, you know, it'll go through and but if you're really having a problem, first make a backup of all your fonts and then just restore the standard fonts in the file menu in Fontbook. That'll get you back to ground zero. I mean, you'll miss all of your great stuff, but it'll rule that out. And I've seen it, you know, I've seen fonts like totally crater a system. So there you go.
Yeah. It's just with the variety of symptoms and apps that were misbehaving.
Yeah.
I just couldn't detect a common thread other than your data's messed up.
Yeah. Well, again, fonts are a common thread. That's the thing is, you know, they are. Right? I mean, they're system-wide. So I'm not necessarily sure that that's the solution here, although it might be, but I like, you know, that's a good one to throw out there and just remember as you're troubleshooting these things that fonts are system-wide, you know, and I've seen them, like, crater a system. Yeah. So.
You're right. And the thing is, yes, you can actually, yeah. So I'm looking right now. I haven't run it a while, but yeah, you can go into Fontbook and highlight your fonts and then say, I think, validate.
File validate.
You'll go through them and say, yeah, you know, they're good or bad or again, duplicates, I think, is something that I've seen wreak havoc. Mm-hmm. You have multiple installations of a font and sometimes that confuses the OS. So,
hey, all right. I wanted to mention, we were, I was talking last show, I guess it was, about that client that had, where I had both the husband and wife using their the same iCloud account because the goal was to share photos. Well, two things about that. Number one, listener David wrote in and suggested leaving them with separate iCloud accounts and using Google Photos to sync both of their libraries to Google Photos. And he's totally right about that. In fact, I had that conversation with them. The problem with Google Photos, of course, is they don't show up in your photos library in the right way. You have to do all this syncing and everything. And while, yes, you could look in Google Photos in the app to see everything, they wanted it all in one place. So we got them there. There was one caveat, though, when you are sharing an iPhone or an iCloud account. And that is that phone calls will ring on the other person's computer unless you go in and turn that off. Yeah. Yeah. So so that I knew I was missing something. But if you go in to settings phone and go to calls on other devices, that's where I had to go to manage where this would happen and not happen. So, yeah. So And Brian Monroe is saying, use iCloud, read the terms and conditions. So we'll come back to that. Maybe you'll explain what you mean by, I'm assuming you mean Google's terms and conditions. But go ahead, John, because I have one thing. I merged all their photos, and I want to talk a little bit about that.
No, I was just tossing out Flickr as a solution, since last I checked, Mac OS and iOS do have some level of Flickr integration.
Yes, so it's true. Yeah.
Checking them out.
You got to pay for it, but yeah.
Well, I'm on the cheapskate plan, and I'm happy. But yeah, you can get the pro.
Right. Yeah, Brian's saying to use a shared album. That's how you do this. Well, you can, but things aren't automatically put into the shared album, which is what they want. They really wanted to have one photo library. And I get that. Like, having a family photo library, everything is all in one place. So, they had someone else work on this machine or work on this problem for them. And so, they gave me this drive that had, once I started, I started looking at it at their house, and I said, wait a minute, we're going to need, like, there's going to be a lot of unsupervised time while these libraries all merge together. So I'm going to go ahead and take this drive home to my office, so I don't have to sit here and bill you for, you know, the hours and hours and hours while these things merge. And so I did. There were no less than 7 iPhoto and or Photos libraries on this drive. So there were about half of them were iPhoto libraries, half were Photos libraries. There were a lot of dupes, but no one thing that duplicated everything. And then there were 2 folders, each with, you know, 100 gigs of data of loose photos in them. And I had no idea how any of this came together, but Power Photos, man, was like saved the day and saved them a bunch of money, because Power Photos will merge, and it'll merge multiple libraries into one, and it'll check for duplicates on the fly. Really, really awesome stuff. So I set up a separate user account. You're going to love this, John. I set up a separate user account on my Mac, started doing all this for them there, and I logged that user account into their iCloud account just for photos. I turned everything else off. And that way, once I finished merging, I merged everything together into a separate library that wasn't their iCloud photo library. But I did have my computer download all their photos so that I could do the final merge here as well. And so I got it all together. I cleaned up this one library that was like merging everything that was on this disk that they gave me. And then the final step was I merged that into their iCloud library. And the best part is now that's on their computers. And I haven't even gone and given them their driver, or actually I haven't even given them a bill. Like, the problem is solved. And because of iCloud, they just magically get the solution pushed to all their devices. Huh. Yeah. So I thought that was pretty good. So, you know, but Power Photos, man, that was the saving grace. Really, really great piece of software. It's totally was stable through the whole thing. I mean, this thing ran for probably 4 days straight on my iMac in the office, just kind of, you know, doing various different crunching. Really? And all that stuff. Oh, I mean, well, I had to constantly, you know, it took like 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there of my time to go over and like, okay, it finished this step. Now the next thing is merge these together and compare and check for dupes. And, you know, so yeah, it was just running constantly, but it did a great job with it. So I'll put a link to Power Photos. I know we've talked about it a million times, but it was the first time that I'd really relied on it, you know, to like get the job done.
I'm glad I've never had a need to use it.
Yeah, well, it's great. Mm. It really, I highly recommend it.
Yeah. Well, especially since, you know, I dove into the, iCloud photo library pond. I'm thrilled. It's awesome. Does everything
right
I would want.
Well, that was the thing, is I just needed to get them there. And it was like, you know, Right. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Hopefully they're happy. They're on vacation. I did send them a note saying, hey, I'm going to do this iCloud merge, but if it starts messing with your devices because you're traveling or whatever, like, let me know. But it shouldn't. So, given how I have them all set up. So, anyway, there you go. It's fun. Yes. As Brian Monroe says, dealing with people's digital clutter can simply take time. Yep. Yeah.
Well, hey, cool. You should extend the tip jar. Maybe get a tip.
That's right. There you go.
Giving such good advice.
Yeah. There you go. They paid me well for my time. It's fine. All right. Should we go to Andrew here?
Where are we?
Let's answer Andrew's question here.
That's another one where, yeah, there's some backroom chatter that we had in this as well. You answer the question that I answered. You'll lead it off, and I will bring up I'll bring up the email where I replied as well, because I think there are multiple answers to this question. None of them right or wrong.
Yeah, who knows? That's the thing. So I'll pose Andrew's question, but I think you have the right answer. He says, I've got a 13-inch MacBook Air purchased in 2017, which was inadvertently upgraded to 10.13.x up from 10.12. I can downgrade and reinstall the older macOS after erasing the internal flash drive, but I have not been able to restore the recovery partition back to the lower recovery partition version of 10.12.x. Any guidance on how to roll it back is greatly appreciated. So my first thought, I have not done this, but my first thought was if you go and boot from something else, not the recovery partition, because recovery partition can't delete itself, but if you go boot from something else and truly repartition the drive, don't just erase the volume that's there, but if you repartition the drive, I thought that would get rid of the recovery partition, and then therefore when you're reinstalling Mac OS and putting 10.12 back on there, that would do it. But sometimes that doesn't, or
I'm pretty sure that's what Apple claims should
that's what
happen.
I thought. Okay,
if you reinstall the OS, especially on a erased drive, it should wipe out and upgrade the
or build
recovery, but it sounds like it didn't.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like it didn't for him. That's right. Yeah. So you found another way, John.
So short of wiping the drive, which he did, and that didn't work. So I found a few other things, Dave, that were pretty interesting.
I want to go into yours, but I do want to make sure, because it's possible that Andrew did not actually wipe the drive, right? When you're in disk utility, you can, and I mentioned this, but I don't want to gloss over it. When you're in disk utility, you can choose the drive or the volume inside the drive, right? And if you choose the volume and erase that, then that does not touch the recovery partition that's there. It's just like the volume, except that it's hidden in disk utility, so you can't see it. But if you go up and choose the drive and choose to repartition it, take the partitions that are there off, put new ones out there, that should wipe the drive, especially if you repartition and just tell it one partition. That should do it. So my guess is he just erased the volume, not the drive.
Because there are different levels.
Correct.
And you can erase at different levels. Okay, so he may not have done a full erase. I'm with you on that.
Yeah, the repartition is the key. Yeah.
But the question I had is, what I think he was saying is that when he went into recovery, so how did he determine that recovery was not the right recovery? Is that I assume that when he ran recovery and then he said reinstall Mac OS, it said, well, hey, you want me to install the latest version? I think that's what he was saying. Do you agree with me on that?
No, he put 10.12 on there, but his recovery partition was still the one from 10.13.
Right. Well, I think that's just what I said.
Oh, okay.
Is how did he know recovery was the wrong version? And the only way I can tell that recovery is the wrong version is that when you try to say reinstall Mac OS, it says to install a version that's not the version.
When you try to say that from within the recovery partition.
Right.
Yes. Or just go to
Just
go to the Apple menu and choose about this Mac, and it'll show you on the recovery partition that you're running High Sierra, not Sierra.
I found it doesn't do that.
It just won't tell you.
No, it's kind of an obscure. The menu, from what I could see, didn't indicate the version of OS that it thought it was running. It's just like, oh, I'm running recovery or disk utility or something like that. So I think. To clarify, I think that's how he determined that the OS on the recovery was different from the OS that he had installed, but. A couple of other tips, Carbon Copy Cloner, which is my favorite, Dave, and I think is yours as well. Carbon Copy Cloner is really good about recovery partition, backing up and restoring, last I checked, and that it points it out. So one suggestion would be, hey, if you have an old backup made with Carbon Copy Cloner, restore from that, and that may fix it.
Yeah.
And then
yeah, it won't create a recovery partition, but it will let you back up and restore them. That's right.
Right. So if he has a backup where it backed up the recovery partition, it would restore it to the new drive. So
yep.
if he has a fairly recent backup that he's confident that he's sure about, then use that. The other thing is, then I did some Google Foo and surfing. And the other thought, Dave, though it's kind of risky, but you could, I mean, I kind of like this one because it's kind of, you know, living on the edge here, but you could delete the recovery partition. And I did find an article that tells you how to do this. So it's actually, you got to dig into the terminal and basically say, okay, delete the recovery partition, which you should be able to say if you, you can run disutil from the terminal and see which one it is, and
yep.
You can erase it and then merge it into, it doesn't take up a lot of space, but then I found an article that said both how to delete it and then how to merge it once you've deleted it into your main partition, and then you could try to reinstall the OS.
And that might create a new one, right?
And then it'd be like, oh, there's no recovery partition. So
yeah, I believe that.
A couple of additional vectors yeah. that you may want to explore here.
But, cool.
All go. Right.
We've got time for a few. We actually have some quick tips here that are intentional quick tips, believe it or not, not just like croutons that you find. So the first is from Russell, who says, in the last few episodes, you have been skirting around, but you haven't said it. There is a command that when invoked properly in the Finder, empties the trash with no other confirmation or interaction. He says, it's what I use every time, but it's a dangerous keyboard shortcut. So be careful and try not to get caught. That is Command, Option, Shift, Delete. Command, Option, Shift, Delete. Deletes, empties everything in the trash, doesn't ask you, doesn't pass go. Whatever's there is gone. So there you go. Be careful. With great power comes great responsibility, but you know, that's okay.
Well, it's four keys, so
it's
hard to fumble.
Right. But you know, still be careful. All right. So that's the first of the quick tips. The second is from Patrick, who says that you can modify the home screen layout of your iPhone or your iPad with Apple Configurator 2. And it's great, actually. I took a screenshot of this. It's you see all of your different screens at once. You can dig into folders and you can move things around very quickly, which is the key. And then you just hit apply and it pushes the changes over to your phone. If you launch Apple Configurator 2, it's in Actions, Modify, Home Screen Layout. So this is really cool because that's often a pain in the neck. So there you go.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think we mentioned it in the past. But
yeah.
Yeah. So Apple Configurator 2 gives back what iTunes took away.
In a better way, I think, too, because iTunes would do it on the fly. So this, you do everything and then you hit apply and you're done. So thank
Plus,
you, Patrick.
The Configurator does a ton of additional cool stuff.
Well, there's that. Yeah.
We're going to talk about.
Right. But there you go. And then David links us to a quick tip at How to Geek that shows how to move multiple apps at once. And the way it works is you get your home screen into jiggly mode. You know, you hold down until it starts doing that. And then you tap and drag one icon to start it moving around the screen. To add another app, you use a different finger and tap its icon while you're holding down the first, and boom, they'll start to stack together. And we've talked about this before, but every time somebody brings it up, I'm just blown away because I forget about it for some reason. I don't know why, but there you go. So So yeah, you just get it into jiggly mode, start moving one app, and before you let that go, just use your, another finger to tap on other apps, and they'll all pile on, and then you can drag them all together. So two different ways to...
Wow.
Yeah, I thought so. Pretty good, right? That's what I got, John. And really, I think that's going to bring us to the outro today.
Wrap it up.
It's time. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. Alex, wait. There might be a bonus quick tip here. Alex says, did you know that with the Magic Mouse, you can move an item and with another finger, you can swipe? I had no idea. Wow. And he says, that way you're dragging and dropping. Man, that's pretty cool.
Well, you had no idea, Dave, but I'm going to give you an idea.
All right.
And that's, if you have a question or comment or tip or cookies or brownies or snacks.
Croutons.
You should send them. Or you are fixated on those croutons.
I'm obsessed.
You should, if you're obsessed with croutons, you should send an email to feedback@macgeekab.com.
I think you said feedback@macgeekab.com.
You are absolutely correct in that I'm going to send you some croutons to feedback@macgeekab.com.
No, I think if you're going to send croutons, you send those to feedback@macgeekab.com. I'm just saying. There you go. You can also, as I mentioned before, premium members can email us at premium@macgeekab.com. We do have a phone number. In fact, we've got quite a few voicemails that I think we're going to be including at least some of them in the next episode. You can call us at 224-888-GEEK, which, John, is
4-3-3-5?
Yeah, and do you see the commas when I every week when I say which John is? Because I do. I see them in front of me. It's beautiful,
what?
In fact.
What are you talking about?
Well, grammatically. You know, that's all. And you can also find us on Facebook. Go to macgeekab.com/Facebook. That'll bring you there. And it's a beautiful thing, which is what I like.
We and like lastly, beautiful things. You yes. haven't mentioned this for a while, but hey, you know, go to iTunes. Look us up.
Oh, give actually, you don't have to. Go to macgeekab.com/iTunes. That'll bring you to where you can review us. Yeah. Yeah.
But reviews are great.
Reviews
Shake
are great.
Shake your fist. Shower us with praise or something in between.
That's right. All right. Well, I want to thank, of course, all of you for listening, all of you for contributing, all the folks in the chat room for helping us out during the show. And I want to thank CashFly at CACHEFLY.com for providing all the bandwidth. Of course, I want to thank all of our sponsors. As we said in this episode, we have Smile at TextExpander.com/podcast. We have Barebones Software at Barebones.com. We have Otherworld Computing at MaxSales.com. We've got RoboForm at RoboForm.com. Two new ones coming in the next episode. Well, I think that's it, John. Do you have any advice to give him?
I think I do. Yeah, it's swirling in the back of my mind here. But I think the thing is, especially with all this terrible weather that we're having in the Northeast and throughout the country here, you want to make sure you stay home. Stay safe and don't get caught.
Made up.